Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory.
Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Nathan Connolly.
I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Joanne Freeman. If you're new to the podcast, we're all historians, along with our colleague Ed Ayers, and each week we explore a topic in American history.
We're going to start today on a farm in California's Central Valley in 1941, where 10-year-old Masumi Kimura lived with her parents.
Central Valley, California, is a place where a lot of Japanese American families were involved in migrant farm working, or in her case, they actually owned their farm.
This is scholar Duncan Ryukin Williams. Several years ago, Masumi Kimura told Duncan about her family's experience living in California after the attack at Pearl Harbor. She said that one day, shortly after the attack, she came home from school and immediately noticed something was terribly wrong.
She comes home from school and she sees her dad at the front door of her farmhouse being beaten by some men in suits, and she peers into the living room and she sees her mom sitting really still at the kitchen table with somebody pointing a shotgun to her mom's head. And she knew in that moment, she's only 10 years old, that she had to kind of be calm and go in the midst of that to serve as a translator, because her parents are from Japan and they don't have much English, and she could tell these men in suits did not have much Japanese. And so, you know, she goes in, and what she discovers in the work of translating was that these men were FBI agents, and that they were there because her dad was on the board of the local Buddhist temple, and that her dad had been out in the lettuce fields with some rabbits or something. So he was like, he had a shotgun and he was shooting in the air to kind of scare them off. But that was, unfortunately, the precise moment when these FBI agents arrived.
Despite only being a kid, Masumi was able to talk down the FBI agents and defuse the situation. But that wasn't the last time they showed up at the Kimura family's doorstep.
They actually came back several times to question him about his involvement in the Buddhist temple and whether he was a threat to national security. But in the midst of all of that, the dad says, look, just because we're Buddhists, we're not a threat to America, but we need to somehow demonstrate to these people that we're loyal to this country. Our daughter's born here, and we've lived here for decades. So in a fire, he kind of takes everything in the house that has like made in Japan or Japanese characters, like things with Japanese language on it, and just throws that in the fire.
Even before Japanese planes attacked Pearl Harbor, Duncan says the federal government were surveilling Japanese Americans, who they deemed as a national security threat. And Buddhists were at the top of the list.
They believed that Japanese Americans who were Christian would likely be more loyal to the United States compared to Buddhists. Right after Pearl Harbor, Buddhist priests are the very first people picked up by the FBI. Back then, it's perhaps parallel to, say, Islam in America today. There was a generalized fear in the media, among the general public, and certainly among the government officials running the intelligence services and the army, that Buddhist priests and temples were potential hotbeds for both espionage and also some kind of fifth column kind of activity that might happen in case of war with Japan, that these temples would be the places where some kind of secret plots would be hatched against the United States. These type of ideas were very common in the late 30s and early 1940s.
Back at the Kimura's farm, as Masumi's father burned every Japanese artifact in the house, he came across something that made him hesitate.
The dad says, look, I have this Buddhist sutra, this Buddhist scripture that's been handed down in our family for generations, and I just can't throw that into the fire. And also, as a temple board member, I've got all of these records from the time of the founding of the temple, the minutes of the board, all the way up to December of 1941. This is not, my personal property that I can just burn.
So he put these items in a box and buried it next to a large tree near the garage. Soon after, they were ordered to relocate to the Fresno Assembly Center and had to sell their farm. They only got 1/20th of the property's market value.
They go to camp, and ultimately they return after the war, and he's like, we need to find that box because the new owners won't let them buy their farm back. But he's like, we still have to find the box. And ultimately, the new owners, because they had torn down all the large trees and torn down the garage, he kind of roughly knew where it was, but that box, he could never find it. I talk about this story because it's a story of a family that had to bury their faith, and that they were saying symbolically, you know, by burning away all that Japanese stuff in the fire, they were saying, we can burn away our Japanese-ness. We don't need to identify with that, but we are not going to burn away our faith because this is what helps us get orientation in this world. And that it's actually a very American thing to do, to defend this idea that you can be of any faith. To me, this story was, can you be both Buddhist and American at the same time? And this is one family's way of saying, yes, we can.
Today on the show, we'll be exploring stories from the history of Buddhism in the United States over the last century.
We'll discuss one woman who went from wealthy Chicago socialite to a Buddhist Zen pioneer.
We'll learn how the Beat Generation popularized certain aspects of Buddhism in America.
And we'll chat with an American Buddhist scholar who's been pals with the Dalai Lama for decades.
Let's return now to my conversation with Duncan Ryukin Williams. I asked him about the opening to his book, American Sutra. It features a poem by a Zen Buddhist priest named Nyogen Senzaki. When Pearl Harbor happened, Senzaki had been in the U.S. for nearly 40 years and had organized a multi-ethnic Buddhist community in Los Angeles.
He writes a poem once he learns of the U.S. Army policy that every Japanese person, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, a threat to national security, if you're an infirmed grandmother or a little tiny baby, everybody's going to go to these camps. He writes a poem called Parting on May 7th, 1940. He's writing it to his multi-ethnic Zen Buddhist community. So he's writing it to the folks in his group who are not, you know, of Japanese ancestry. This is the poem that he writes. Thus have I heard. The army ordered all Japanese faces to be evacuated from the city of Los Angeles. This homeless monk has nothing but a Japanese face. He stayed here 13 springs meditating with all faces from all parts of the world and studied the teaching of Buddha with them. Wherever he goes, he may form other groups, inviting friends of all faces, beckoning them with the empty hands of Zen. And the reason I opened the book with this poem, in part because of this first line, thus have I heard. It's a phrase that is used in classical Buddhist scriptures, sutras. When the Buddha was alive and he was preaching, nobody wrote it down. And so 3 months after the Buddha's death, they had this big assembly of Buddhist priests. And one of the monks, Ananda, is supposed to have a great memory. He apparently was requested to recite all of the Buddhist sermons in front of everybody, and they would kind of like agree that that's what the Buddha said. But he would always preface what he recalled with, thus have I heard. So that phrase is an indication of a Buddhist scripture. And what is fascinating here is that usually what follows is, you know, Buddhist lessons on wisdom or compassion or meditation or something like that. But in Nyogen Senzaki's poem, he's just describing the lived experience of the Japanese American community being removed by the U.S. Army, but with this kind of hope that wherever he goes, he may form other groups, inviting friends of all faces with the empty hands of Zen. So he's saying he's hopeful that some kind of multi-ethnic American Buddhist community might even come out of this army policy or despite it. And so to me, it's an interesting thing that the Buddhist lesson that's being taught here is something about this lived experience of forced removal and incarceration is actually going to be a lesson, not only for Buddhists, but perhaps for Americans of every stripe.
Tell us what you've heard and what you've read about the conditions in the actual camps, the assembly centers and such, for Japanese American Buddhists, and particularly how Buddhism was practiced in those camps, in those spaces.
One of the first challenges that they faced when they got to these euphemistically called assembly centers, this is while the long-term war relocation authority camps, 10 of them, were being built to house 120,000 people. They first went to these temporary assembly centers. They were often at fairgrounds, county fairgrounds, or livestock centers, or horse racing tracks, like in the one in L.A. that Nogen Senzaki went to. He lived literally in a horse stall where you could smell the urine and the manure that had been there just weeks before these Japanese were placed there. And so that in that kind of context, they enter the assembly centers, and the first rule that they are informed about is that the army is prohibiting anything written in Japanese, including Buddhist scriptures or even like a book of Japanese poetry. That's considered contraband, and that you got to take that out of your suitcase as you enter these places. But the two exceptions they made to that policy was that if you had a dictionary that had English and Japanese in it, that was okay. But and if you had a Christian Bible written in Japanese, that was okay.
Wow.
So the message they got, there's a kind of assumed, I sometimes call it Anglo-Protestant normativity, but like this idea of Anglo both in the sense of whiteness, but also in the sense of, you know, English only. That's what the government expected. The other big thing in these camps was the creation, like very creatively sometimes, of a way to practice Buddhism despite the fact that you don't have your normal surroundings and the normal ritual items and so forth. And so the very first big ceremony once you get in these camps is April of 1942. It's the Buddha's birthday. It happens every April. And in one camp, they didn't have anybody with a Buddha statue that you normally would use. You usually have a ceremony on the Buddha's birthday where you pour sweet tea on a statue of a baby Buddha. They had neither, but they did have army rationed coffee and some sugar. And so they made a sweet coffee drink. And one of the young men went to the mess hall and found the largest carrot that he could find and carved, you know, at least a semblance of a Buddha out of that carrot. And so they poured that sweet coffee on this carrot Buddha. So that's the kind of thing that they had to do to recreate Buddhist practice in these camps, because they just didn't have anything. And I think they were actually very creative in so doing.
Now, you actually discovered a Japanese-American intelligence officer who was captured by the Japanese military. What was that story?
So 6,000 Japanese-Americans served in the Pacific. Now, if you can imagine conducting the war against the Japanese, Imperial Japanese Army and Imperial Japanese Navy in the Pacific required people who were linguistically and culturally bilingual, bicultural, because you needed to have people that could do code breaking. You needed people to do prisoner interrogation, radio intercepts. And so roughly 6,000 Japanese Americans served in that theater of combat. And one of the people, one of those 6,000, was a guy called Richard Sakakita. Before the war, he's a head cadet in the ROTC at his local high school in Honolulu, Hawaii. He gets the first Japanese American to get a full scholarship offer to go to West Point.
Wow.
But he's also from a very devout Buddhist family, and he gets a full scholarship offer from the bishop of his sect of Buddhism to go to Japan and become the first Japanese American to go and train in Japan, become and kind of like come back as a missionary, as it were, a Buddhist priest. And so he ultimately rejects both of those things in the late 1930s and gets recruited to serve in the counterintelligence corps in the Philippines, even prior to the Pearl Harbor attack. So he's kind of embedded in the American intelligence operations there. You know, as the Philippines fell, thousands of Americans were taken prisoner by the Japanese, often experiencing brutal marches and prison camps. But Sakakita is one of them, the only Japanese-American among the Americans captured by the Japanese. So he is targeted by the Japanese military, tortured for days. And he gets through that torture because of his Buddhist faith and what he calls his rebellious Yankee spirit. He kind of merged the two things to get through the torture and not reveal any kind of American secrets to his captors. And so the story of Sakakita is really fascinating. He goes through so many adventures. He engineers prison breaks. He himself manages to escape from the hands of the Japanese. MacArthur had sent six different rescue teams to try to get him out because he was such an important intelligence asset. They all fail. But he himself engineers his escape, lives in the jungle for some time, gets captured by some headhunting Aboriginal tribe in the Philippines, nearly dies, is wounded again. Anyway, he goes through this adventure and finally, after the right at the end of the war, reunites with the U.S. Army. MacArthur says, look, Sakakita, you need to head the War Crimes Tribunal for the entire territory of the Philippines. And so he gets assigned to do that job. And in that process, he tracks down the three officers that had tortured him during the war. And in the moment that he meets them, he comes to recall this Buddhist teaching that he learned when he was growing up in Honolulu, Hawaii. He remembers this phrase from the Dhammapada, Buddhist scripture, that says, like fire is not put out by fire, but only by water. Hatred is put out by love and not by hatred. Mm-hmm. And so he recalls this phrase and in that moment forgives these people that tortured him. So to me, this is a really interesting American story of somebody who really served his country and is recognized so by the highest levels of the U.S. military, but is somebody who did that drawing both on his deep Buddhist faith, but also his deep faith in America as well.
Keeping with the theme of the aftermath of the war and moments of humanity in its wake, what happens to American Buddhism writ large in the wake of internment, and in what ways does it spread across the United States after the war?
So one of the things that happens in the process of resettlement, as it's sometimes called, people couldn't go back to the West Coast until 1945. But in the meantime, in 44, some Buddhists were able, if they could pass, they called it the sometimes colloquially known as the loyalty questionnaire, they were able to leave camp, and places like Chicago, New York, Baltimore, places east of this Western Defense Command Zone on the Pacific Coast, quite a few thousand of the 120,000 people in these camps were able to leave camp a little bit early before the end of the war, and there they set up these Buddhist temples. And in so doing, the temple served as a community center for these people that were in further dislocation and trying to resettle and recreate their lives. But also, they introduced Buddhism to people in these areas of the United States that previously didn't really have very much exposure to the Buddhist religion. And so you found people of other ethnicities taking an interest, coming to these temples in New York, in Chicago, in Denver. And this was the beginning of what would later become, in the 1950s and 60s and into the 70s, this kind of beat generation, kind of the counterculture, hippie movement, these parts of the American community being exposed to Buddhism for the first time.
My sense from your own work is that you're describing a unique form of Buddhism that comes, in a lot of ways, that flowers out of this experience. How does this discussion of the Japanese-American Buddhist experience generally tell us about religion and Buddhism's durability as a part of American life?
Well, one of the things that when one studies, let's say, the 2,500-year history of Buddhism, is that when it moved from its original roots in India and moved to, say, China, or from China to Japan or to Tibet, or each time it moves, there's a concept in Buddhism called, in Japanese, it's called hoben, but it's skillful adaptation. And so this idea of kind of like smartly, skillfully adapting the Buddhist teaching to each time and place. And so the story of the emergence in an unlikely moment when Buddhism is in some sense under attack is actually the very moment where something called American Buddhism gets crystallized, where certain kinds of adaptations start happening. There are these pressures to say, hey, I am loyal to the United States in this time of war, and that my faith is what gives me direction and guidance. And so they didn't want to abandon that, and yet they also wanted to find a way to say, our religion is not a threatening thing. And so among the many things that happened, using more English terminology, sometimes even using Christian terminology, like in 1944, in one of the camps, one of the large organizations that used to be called the Buddhist Mission of North America, BMNA, goes to court and changes their name to the BCA, the Buddhist Churches of America. And so this idea of like doing church or meeting on Sundays and things like that, that process already was happening before the war to a certain extent, but becomes very much crystallized in the camps. And so what emerges is a kind of new form of Buddhism, American Buddhism.
Duncan Ryukin Williams is the author of the book American Sutra, a story of faith and freedom in the Second World War. He's also the director of the Shinzo Ito Center for Japanese Religions and Culture at the University of Southern California.
There's a sense of pride that comes with being able to talk confidently and intelligently about a subject. And that's why we're big fans of the Great Courses Plus. With this streaming service, you have the freedom to learn more about virtually any topic, and not just get the basics, but truly master it, learning unique perspectives from top scholars in the field who are passionate about their topics. There's unlimited access to thousands of lectures on topics like ancient civilizations of North America, history of Russia, even the chances of life on Mars. And with the Great Courses Plus app, you can watch or listen on any device. And I have to say, I recommend checking out Ed Ayers, who has one of those courses on this website, A New History of the American South. Obviously, it's great because it's Ed Ayers, so check it out. Get that awesome feeling of pride that comes with knowledge. Sign up for the Great Courses Plus. We've worked out a fantastic limited-time offer for our listeners, a full month for free. But to start your free month, you need to sign up through our special URL. Go now to thegreatcoursesplus.com/backstory. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/backstory. As the government labeled Buddhists a threat to national security during World War II, one woman sought to bridge the divide between the Buddhist East and the American West. Her name was Ruth Fuller Sasaki. She was the first Westerner and woman to be named priest of a Rinzai Zen Buddhist temple.
It still is astounding to me because it probably won't even happen again. So it was a first and only kind of situation.
This is Isabel Sterling. She wrote a biography about Ruth Fuller Sasaki called Zen Pioneer. From the 1930s through the 60s, Sterling says Ruth helped lay the foundation for Zen in America by creating Buddhist institutes, supporting Zen teachers, and translating numerous Buddhist texts into English.
She was not a university person, And yet she put together a translation team of some of the most brilliant scholars in that area. And it was this interesting combination of they were young men, and it was right after the war, and they were interested in the topic. And she had, of course, Gary Snyder was working with her on the translation team, and her daughter had married Alan Watts, so she was passionate, and she had the resources to hire them. She was like at the center hub of people interested in Zen Buddhism coming to Japan and in trying to get people in Japan who were Zen Buddhist teachers interested in coming to the U.S.
For myself, I believe that Zen practice is one of the most remarkable religious disciplines men have devised, and that the fruits of the practice are beyond price. Therefore, though real Zen students may be few, for those few, it seems to me important that this discipline be preserved and made available.
Though she spent most of her life promoting Buddhism's humble practices, Ruth actually came from less than humble beginnings. She grew up in Chicago in a well-to-do family who sent Ruth as a young woman across Europe to study piano and foreign languages. But Ruth's life started to change course in her 20s after she visited an eccentric country club outside New York City.
There was a place in Nyack, New York called the Clarkstown Country Club where people like herself who wanted sort of a retreat and a rest could go. And it was a place that wasn't just a retreat or a country club. It was a place started by Pierre Bernard. He was a Eastern mystic interested in yoga in particular and started this place as a rest and healing place, but also as a country club. They had elephants. I mean, this place is incredible. He had a huge library, 7,000 books or so on Sanskrit and Eastern philosophies.
After she absorbed these materials, Ruth ventured to Kyoto, Japan, to explore Zen Buddhism through meditation.
She rented a house on the Kamo River, and every day she would go, and the Zen master had a completely little private temple in his compound where she would sit all day at specified intervals and then go home again.
She kept doing this for weeks, going to her own little space to meditate every day while all of the monks sat in the meditation hall called the Zendo. Until one day, the Zen master invited her to join them, much to the chagrin of the male monks who were skeptical of a woman and a foreigner being invited into the Zendo.
She went over and got settled on it and sat very quietly and had good posture and then went back home. And they said, oh, that was so good, you could come back another night. And pretty soon they said, okay, you're serious. You can come sit in the meditation hall. A little bit later, I thought it was kind of funny because she said one night during these intensive weeks, the sitting went on for quite long hours. And one night she said that the Zen master, the Roshi, was bellowing and making lots of noise, and she had no idea what he was saying to the monks. And it turned out he was saying, you're all lazy, you're going to have to sit all night. All she knew is they didn't have a break. So at the end of that period, they had to carry her off the tan, which is like a bench where all the cushions are set, because her legs were completely paralyzed from all this sitting.
Despite her temporary paralysis, Ruth regarded this time meditating in the temple as
the most completely satisfactory time I have ever had in my life. Under any circumstances, sitting in a Zendo is wonderful. The big quiet room, the dim light, the faint smell of coarse incense, the cold, fresh air, the sounds of the night coming from a distance, passing voices, the throb of a Nichiren drum, the notes of a flute, the Chinese noodle man's whistle, all melt into you. Sometime I hope you all know the experience.
After her sojourn in Japan, Ruth returned to the United States and began to study with a man she would eventually marry, Sokei An Sasaki. He was one of the first Zen teachers to live and teach in the United States. Ruth decided to buy a brownstone in New York City and use it as the headquarters for Sokei An's burgeoning group, the Buddhist Society of America. They opened the space on December 6, 1941. The next day was Pearl Harbor.
They realized that the FBI was watching them from across the street. They could see the people come and go, and they were under observation. And she was interviewed, and Sokei An was interviewed. And then he was taken to Ellis Island on June 15th of 1942, and then interned at Fort Meade, Maryland.
Even with Sokei An detained and the U.S. government casting a threatening cloud over Buddhism, Ruth continued the work of the Buddhist Society of America, and for the next 2 years, she lobbied to get Sokei An released from the internment camp. She succeeded in 1943, but by then, Sokei An's health was deteriorating.
They were married in 1944, and a year later, he died. So part of what influenced the rest of her life was he wanted her to go back to Japan. He wanted her to find another Zen teacher for the group. He just wanted her to continue the work.
The problem of how to get the true line of Zen teaching transplanted into America in the shortest possible time is with me night and day. I feel its speedy accomplishment is imperative, or Zen may be lost to humanity.
Ruth returned to Kyoto, Japan, and got to work recruiting a new Zen teacher to take Sokei An's place. During her time in Kyoto, she also put together a research team that translated several Buddhist texts while publishing her own insights on Buddhism. Meanwhile, she traveled around the United States giving lectures to scholars and non-academics about her Buddhist explorations. And finally, in 1958, she was ordained as the first Westerner and woman to be a priest of a Rinzai Zen temple in Kyoto.
The actual event of that did break barriers. At first, she resisted it because she said, I don't want to go to all those meetings, and I don't really want to be a priestess, you know, of this and have to do all the things that are traditionally expected. So she resisted it a little bit. But she realized that the event of having that happen would give it an authenticity that would help her in her goal of getting more recognition from the Zen teachers in Japan to maybe want to come and do more in the U.S.
Ruth Fuller Sasaki died of a sudden heart attack in 1967, just shy of her 75th birthday. Sterling says Ruth's work and dedication helped ignite a passion for Zen Buddhism in a Western audience that continues to grow today.
She saw that it was the long view, not the short view, that would matter. It's like Gary Snyder said recently, the early history of Zen Buddhism to the West is still in its beginning stages. So we look at it and say, well, let's see, what did they accomplish in the last 50 years? But it's still the early beginning.
Isabel Sterling is the author of the book Zen Pioneer, The Life and Works of Ruth Fuller Sasaki.
The 1950s marked the emergence of the Beat Generation in the United States. The Beats created a style all their own, with themes of restlessness and nonconformity filtered through a kind of jazz-like prose. But they were much more than just a literary phenomenon. The Beats sparked a countercultural movement that rejected mainstream society and, in the process, helped spread Buddhism in America. I caught up with scholar Kyle Garten-Gunling to talk about Buddhism and the Beat Generation. He's an expert on the assimilation of Eastern religions in American literature. I started by asking why the Beats were drawn to the Buddhist tradition.
The Beats thought of themselves as a countercultural movement. They were rebelling against what they saw as the stifling conformity of the post-World War II 1950s. And when they were looking around for various ideologies that could help them promote their rebellious agenda, what they saw in Asian religions such as Buddhism was an alternative to the dominant Christianity of mainstream American society. So, whereas the Christian God had this vision of being like some kind of tyrannical king, Buddhism was a non-theistic religion that in their minds was a better platform for free expression and spontaneity. And so they also used certain Buddhist role models in the past who were wandering monks as models for a kind of delinquent itinerancy that again was this kind of way of resisting the middle class stability that they thought was stifling and conformist.
Well, who were the best known Beat Buddhists? Name some of them and tell us what they were about.
I think there are three Beat Buddhists in particular who really stand out, and they are Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, and Jack Kerouac. And those three guys all knew each other very well, and they traveled in the same circles, and they all influenced each other in many ways. And they all shared in common this investment in using and reinterpreting Buddhist teachings to revitalize what they thought of as an American spirit that has been forgotten in the post-war climate. They thought of themselves as trying to revive an authentic sense of American revolution, kind of in the spirit of Walt Whitman. But they also thought that America needed something outside of its own Western traditions to really overcome the momentum of its increasingly conformist consumerism. And so to them, Buddhism, with its ideals of non-attachment and emptiness, was a way of trying to get people to be less attached to material things in a time when material prosperity was an increasingly high priority in American middle-class society.
I understand that these guys hung out with each other, but could you describe any differences between the three or characteristics that separated the three of them?
Well, I think there's two different areas where you might talk about some differences. One difference is the level of seriousness with which they actually learned about Buddhism. So Jack Kerouac was notoriously sloppy. He got a lot of things wrong. He was very appropriative and stereotyping a lot of things. Allen Ginsberg started out a little sloppy, but he got more and more serious as he went on. Like later in life in the 70s, he became a student of the Tibetan teacher Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche and became a very serious and diligent student of traditional forms of Buddhist meditation. Gary Snyder was kind of the most serious of all from beginning to end. He actually spent lots of time in Japan over a roughly 12-year period from the early 50s to late 60s, training in actual Zen monasteries in Japan, and has continued to be a very kind of serious and well-read practitioner who could actually work in the original languages. Another area where there's some differences is how optimistic they were about how well you could actually make this cross-cultural adaptation work. So Gary Snyder was an optimist. He thought that you could have a very harmonious blending of East and West. Kerouac was very much less optimistic. He felt very conflicted, and his tortured soul kind of expressed itself in being very unsure whether Americans were actually ready for Buddhism. Allen Ginsberg, again, is somewhere in the middle. He kind of was optimistic in many ways, but pessimistic in others. So I think you could talk both about their degree of seriousness and their degree of optimism in terms of how they kind of tried to bring Buddhism to an American audience.
And what was distinctly American about the kind of Buddhism that was practiced by the Beats?
The Beats justified Buddhist philosophy in their minds using the language of American individualism and American revolution. So they said that just as the Buddha taught to create a revolution for ourselves by turning away from our selfish desires. This actually is a better version of American freedom than Americans already knew, that Buddhist ideals were actually the ultimate fulfillment of the aspiration for American freedom as expressed in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. So their strong investment in American ideals and actually attempting to directly synthesize American and Buddhist ideals is what makes Beat Buddhism distinctly American.
And how would you distinguish the differences between American and Buddhist conceptions of freedom?
Well, generally speaking, American versions of freedom kind of have their most paradigmatic expression in the Declaration of Independence, where in Thomas Jefferson's language, everybody has the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So when he says the pursuit of happiness, what he means is something like the ability to pursue the things that you want. But in a Buddhist version of freedom, it's actually the exact opposite. It's not that we should pursue the things we want, it's that the pattern of wanting things makes us unfree. Our desires are what keep us in chains. Our desires keep us unsatisfied. So in a way, it's very difficult to reconcile these seemingly contradictory ideas of freedom. But the Beats tried to do the impossible, and they came up with a lot of really interesting poetry and fiction in the process.
From your writing, I get the sense that these Beats were really using Buddhism as a lens through which to critique American society. Could you give us a concrete example of how that worked?
So one example I can give comes from a book by Jack Kerouac called The Dharma Bums, which is the most famous text about Buddhism that Kerouac wrote. And in that book, he has these fictional versions of himself and Gary Snyder, and it's pretty obvious who they really are. Like, he slightly changes the names, but you can tell who they are. And he has this fictional version of Gary Snyder named Jafe Ryder, so the scansion is the same even. And he has this character say that in America, you're supposed to work for the privilege of consuming, but what is it all for? And instead, a Buddhist ideal of freedom is much better. And what he says is that we need a revolution that both affirms American freedom, but also critiques current American complacency, which Kerouac thought of as a corruption of a more authentic American freedom. And there's a specific passage that's very famous that I think is worth reading, and I have it written down here, so I'll read it for you. So this character says, "I see a vision of a great rucksack revolution, of thousands or even millions of young Americans wandering around with rucksacks, going up to mountains to pray, making children laugh and old men glad, making young girls happy and old girls happier, all of them Zen lunatics." So in that passage, Kerouac is trying to take this Buddhist notion of eccentric spontaneity and is directly using it to critique American society and encourage people to stop just going to their boring jobs and doing what they're told and go wander off in the wilderness and find enlightenment. So that's kind of how he uses Buddhism to critique American society.
I think that's a terrific example, but I also imagine that they had notions of at least reforming, if not radically revising, mainstream society. How did they expect that they could do that?
Well, I don't think they could expect that they could actually do it, but they were going to try. And I mentioned earlier that there's some different levels of optimism or pessimism in a lot of the Beat Buddhists. And Jack Kerouac was the most pessimistic, and he said, "I'm not sure Americans can handle Buddhism. The very reason that Americans need Buddhism, their attachments to stuff, is what makes it so hard for Americans to accept." So it's a catch-22. Allen Ginsberg, though, did think that it was worth trying to use Buddhism directly in social activism. So, for example, in the 60s during the Vietnam years, this is a bit after the height of the Beat Generation, but still he's working in that mode, he tried to actually use Asian mantras from Buddhism and Hinduism and combine it with Western protest chanting when he was leading protests against the Pentagon in the Vietnam War. So he wanted to use Asian religions to create a new kind of protest movement, one that was directly politically active, but one that wasn't angry like the old left, but more kind of uplifting and actually happy, even though it was also protesting injustice.
Well, I'm guessing that didn't go viral, but were there other ways that the Beat Generation tried to popularize Buddhism in America?
Well, they tried to popularize it by getting a lot of media attention. The Beats were actually pretty successful at making it look like they were more influential than they really were. So there were lots of profiles of Beat writers and interviews with them in widely read publications like Time Magazine, Life Magazine, The Paris Review, and so on. So through these mass-marketed magazines, a lot of Americans became familiar with Buddhism because of what the Beat Generation writers were saying about it. There is a 1957 issue of Time Magazine that declared that 1957 was the year of what they called the Zen Boom. And the Zen Boom was mainly due to Beats popularizing Buddhism, helping it to gain media attention and a much broader audience than it had before.
Earlier, you talked about existing West Coast Buddhist community, existing Eastern Buddhist communities. What did those communities feel about these, you know, Beat Buddhists?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot of direct interaction between Beat Buddhist writers and Asian immigrants who practiced Buddhism as a part of their ethnic tradition. But when there was, it was often a relatively tense affair. You know, Beat Buddhists did tend to view their version of Buddhism as more authentic than the Japanese or Chinese Buddhists. That was obviously very offensive to the Asian Buddhists, who said, "Who are you people coming in here and appropriating Buddhism and then saying that you're doing it better than us?" And what the Beats were doing is they tried to emphasize meditation and philosophy, whereas the Asian American Buddhists focused more on devotional practices and maintaining a physical shrine and having ritual community.
So once the dust settled, what was the impact of Beat Buddhism on American society more broadly?
I think the biggest impact is that from the Beat Generation onward, the overall image of Buddhism in the U.S. became firmly entangled with the counterculture. And that was not the case prior to the Beat Generation. Before the Beats, the people who knew about Buddhism were considered slightly odd intellectuals, but not particularly countercultural. It was after the Beat Generation firmly popularized Buddhism with their own countercultural stamp on it that every generation of spiritual seekers in America after that got Buddhism through that countercultural lens. So the Beat Generation with the 50s, the hippie movement in the 60s, the transcendental meditation movement in the 80s, and so on and so forth, that countercultural stamp has never really gone away. Even to this day, the way that people learn about Buddhism is mainly through these kind of new agey publications that have usually beat or hippie pedigrees if you connect the dots back far enough. So that countercultural image and version of Buddhism is the Beat Generation's most lasting legacy.
Kyle Garten Gunling is an English professor at Christopher Newport University. He's the author of Enlightened Individualism: Buddhism and Hinduism in American Literature, from the Beats to the Present.
As a kid growing up in New York City in the 1950s, Robert Thurman was searching for an answer to one of life's harsh realities.
Unhappy endings suck, and I wasn't really into tragedy. I didn't like it. I felt there must be a way of really understanding life.
Since then, Robert Thurman has devoted his life to studying, teaching, and practicing Tibetan Buddhism. He's regarded as one of the leading scholars on the topic and recently retired from a long career as professor at Columbia University. Along the way, he's had 5 kids, including actress Uma Thurman, opened a cultural center called Tibet House with Richard Gere, and served as an advisor and friend to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. In 1965, the Dalai Lama ordained Robert as the first American Buddhist monk in the Tibetan tradition, even though Robert says the Dalai Lama avoids converting people to Buddhism.
He's not trying to spread Buddhism as a religious thing where he would convert somebody away from Judaism or Christianity or Islam or Hinduism or whatever other religion. He just wants them to learn about their minds. But Buddhism as a religion where you adopt a creed and then you change your cultural setting and you drop out from what the Dalai Lama calls your grandmother's religion, he's not in favor of that. And he wants to help people where they are, you know, instead of sort of change them and make them into some kind of Tibetans or into Buddhists. But then finally I said, okay, don't worry, Rollins. You didn't, or Geshe La did not convert me from Christianity to Buddhism.
I talked more with Robert about his introduction to Buddhism and how he initially crossed paths with the Dalai Lama decades ago. He says losing an eye in a garage accident in the early 1960s sparked his Buddhist awakening.
My first guru, what they call my root teacher, he told me I should always say when I mention it that I lost the one eye and gained 1,000. That's what he said. I should always say. So I'm just following his thing. And that gave me, I would call it like a midlife crisis at 20. And that was lucky, although it was agonizing, of course, and annoying and whatever. But it was really lucky because I then decided that my sense of looking for something else, which was what Buddhism was representing to me already by then, you know, and I was sort of reading it, but then I would just go and have fun, you know. But looking for something else, that I should really look for something else, that life and death was a big thing, and that somebody in India did know, and I was going to find out on the trail of the Buddha, you know. So that was my luck, actually. Otherwise, I might have stuck with what I was with a kind of dilettante view of it. But I started in the 60s because of that accident, which was just turned out to be great fortune in my view. And then, bam, I met the Tibetans who had just come out starting in 59 with His Holiness 2.5 years earlier. And they were kind of getting their bearings there in India. And then I realized they really knew what it was. And somehow I went nuts over the Tibetans, you know, probably previous life thing. But then luckily I had to return to America for a family thing. And then I met in New Jersey a Mongolian Lama who had been in Tibet. And I'll tell you, every time I see on the Karate Kid, that Mongolian Lama was just like that teacher in the Karate Kid. I'm not kidding. He was just like him.
Is this a second life thing for the Karate Kid?
I guess so.
Well, you mentioned the Holiness, the Dalai Lama. Tell me about the first time you met him. What was that like?
Well, what happened was after about 1.75 years with my Mongolian teacher, I kept badgering him about ordaining me as a monk. I wanted robes, you know, shaved head. I wanted the whole trip, you know. And he said, no. You just live like it as a student, that's fine, but it's not in your future. It's not going to happen for you. So finally, he had to go to India, and he had to go and report to the Dalai Lama, and he had to help some Mongolian monks who were a little bit more impoverished even than the Tibetans in India. So I have to go to India. I'll take you with me, and I'll leave you with the Dalai Lama, and maybe he'll make you a monk, he said, since you're bugging me all the time. He said, this kid is a little crazy, American, very smart. He speaks Tibetan already. He wants to be a monk, which he shouldn't do, because he's not going to be a monk in the future, I'm sure. But I'm just an old Mongolian. You're the Dalai Lama. You decide. But he did warn the Dalai Lama that I was, that even though I really was sincere, that I wouldn't stay. So then the Dalai Lama looked me over, and then he took me under his wing for about 1.5 years. And then he finally, toward the end of that time, he did make me a monk at my continuing insistence. And we became really good buddies. And he and I had this great dialogue because I was only the second person, I think, in his life who was already fluent in Tibetan. that he could discuss Freud and the American Constitution and democracy and nuclear physics and whatever, although I wasn't that good at nuclear physics, but and psychology and things, you know, and he could discuss all those kind of things with me. And then I was really interested in what he was also studying, but that was really nice.
And when you came back to the United States, you did run into countercultural types like Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder, who embraced elements of Buddhism. How did that go?
Well, we got along really well, actually. And they had been doing Japan stuff, and they didn't know much about Buddhism. Actually, they sort of met Tibetan stuff through me at that time, and they began to see something interesting about it, connecting to Zen, but something different and deeper than Zen in a certain way, the learning element of Buddhism, which people, you know, took years, decades for people to begin to realize that it's not just meditating, there's something to learn. And there are Buddhist sciences, especially sciences of the mind, and which has been sort of my job all these years. That time, that was news to them, and they were beginning to kind of get into it. But at the same time, all my peers were out with the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. Now we're talking 65, 66, 66, really. And so I would go out and meet them, and I was trying to help them. And then I went to see some old friends of mine from Cambridge who were in the psychedelic movement, trying to get them to meditate without acid, you know. So then the old Mongolian Lama said, well, if you want to go out and be activist with your friends, you can't do that as a monk living all over the place, you know, in this and that place. You have to stay in the monastery. If you stay in the monastery, you can't go out and do that. So which are you having to do? And eventually I realized I had this karmic thing of trying to change the world in a certain way, you know, and that being locked up in the monastery was not possible.
Where does academia fit into all of this, Bob? Because you're a very successful professor. Why academia?
Academia is really great. After I quit being a monk, I resigned. So what can I do with my life, you know, be a waiter and whatever? And I did make a choice then, with the help of a wonderful lady that I fell in love with after having quit. She takes no responsibility for my quitting being a monk, which means celibate, you know. Only after I had resigned did I meet her. But with her help, I decided to be a professor in the sort of Western monastery, let's call it, which is academia, rather than try to start a Dharma center or something, you know, like some other ex-monks have done in American Buddhism. Because then I would sort of have a day job in a way. I wouldn't depend on having disciples and having to create kind of a Dharma center empire type of thing, you know. And I was a little very resistant to it, actually. I thought, oh, academia, I left there long ago. Who needs it? They just do this and that. But then I got to really see that there's something great about our liberal arts education system. It still has that element in it. You know, like an Emersonian element of follow your bliss, you know, find your values, you know, that aspect is good. And it fits actually with the Buddhist exploration of the meaning of life and the meaning of what it's all about very well, you know.
I just want to hear what your thoughts are on the popularity of what we might call secular mindfulness meditation centers. A mindfulness without...
I love it.
You love it. I didn't see that coming. Tell me about that.
I love it. I love it. They can secularize as much as they want. It's like secularized yoga. People who go to do yoga instead of, you know, jogging. You know, it's not, of course, the whole thing of mindfulness because it doesn't address the ethical element. It's not a matter of addressing some sort of credo, religious credo. That's not necessary even in Buddhist mindfulness. It's Buddhist mindfulness just becoming more aware of how your mind works. And the fact that they don't do the full thing of mindfulness of actually beginning to edit your inner mental habits and things, they just kind of want you to become more aware of it and able to dissociate from the negative ones, which is what some people, and I like that they are criticizing that by saying it's too superficial. I have a good friend who just wrote a nice book called McMindfulness, where he criticizes them. And I like him. He's a good friend. And I'm glad he's criticizing them. But on the other hand, maybe he's being asking too much in the sense that any development in our population of people who decide They're not going to just depend on outside substances or experts. You know, they're not going to just ask for a Prozac or something, but they're going to learn to calm themselves down by becoming aware of what's going on in their mind. So, in other words, I love it that people are becoming more self-reliant in these ways without any involvement of Buddhism. This is one thing I want to say about Buddhism, because our culture, whenever we think we're talking about religion, it just gets too serious. We think it's really serious.
Correct.
You know, get over religion. And then Buddhism gets distorted into that very much, because first noble truth is the truth of suffering, that if you insist on being an idiot, you're going to be unhappy. That's not really a genius insight. That's obvious. You know, the key thing about Buddha's discovery is that you can be happy, that you have a right to it. You have access to it. Happiness is the nature of life. The world likes us. Plants are producing oxygen for us to breathe if we don't, like, smother them all. You know, if you behave sensibly, the world loves you. And Buddha wants people to be happy. That's the key thing. And that was his discovery, and that's why he's popular. And Asian people are not people who don't like to be happy, and only Americans like to be happy. Asian people are very good at being happy. They had the Kama Sutra like 2,000 years ago, way before Shades of Grey. And this is a key thing. And I think that hasn't been brought out enough. And in my retirement, it's a dangerous to promote happiness, actually, I think. They think you're asking them all to get stoned or something, or you're competing with the Prozac manufacturers. And I would like to compete with them, because I don't, you know, real self-reliance, self-developed yogic happiness doesn't have bad side effects.
That's going to do it for us today, but you can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of the episode, or ask us your questions about history. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org, or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.